funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be an American? Of course, there are 317 million possible answers to that question, and our family's cultural backgrounds can play a major role in how we understand ourselves and the society in which we live. My guest has spent a lot of time considering who he is as the U.S.-born son of Chinese immigrant parents and thinking about how his connections to his heritage have made him the patriot, the professional, and the parent he is today. Eric Liu is founder and CEO of Citizen University and a correspondent for The Atlantic. He also worked as a speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. His new book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. Eric, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by talking about your title, which, to be honest, is an expression I would feel very uncomfortable using in any other context. But it's one that your father found rather amusing.
It is, in both counts. It's an expression that has pretty much, thankfully, fallen out of usage, but originates from a time in the 1850s when Chinese immigrants were first coming here in large numbers and were doing some of the most thankless work around, whether it was mining mountains, laying railroad track. And the idea was that people were given these awful jobs where you had a low chance of survival, to put it another way, a Chinaman's chance of survival. And my dad, when he emigrated here to the United States, he'd been born in China, went through Taiwan. And when he came here in the late 50s, he was such an enthusiastic sponge, in a way, for American language and idiom and cultural mores. And somewhere along the way, I never actually knew from his early years here where he heard this, but he heard this phrase, a Chinaman's chance. And he decided, in, I think, classic immigrant fashion, that he was going to reappropriate this thing that was being used against him and people who looked like him and sounded like him. He was going to use it in a very playful, joyful, delightful way. And so when I was growing up, as a kid, my dad would just use this phrase in everyday prosaic situations. if we were late to the grocery store and we weren't going to get there before closing time, he'd say, "Uh-oh, we have a Chinaman's chance of getting there before they close." Or if my favorite baseball team was down by 4 runs in the 9th inning, he'd say, "Oh, looks like they've got a Chinaman's chance of winning this game." And he loved to kind of poke fun at it, at the idea that society was trying to make fun of him. And sort of impart to me this notion that you can take anything that's being used against you and flip it if you choose to.
The loss of your father, who died when you were a very young man, is a thread that runs throughout this memoir. Can you talk a little bit about how he viewed his identity as an immigrant to the United States and the ways in which that identity both united the two of you and also divided you in some ways, made you different from one another?
Well, you know, it's kind of remarkable, Chris, as we're sitting here having this conversation. I've now lived more of my life without my father than I have with. Mm. Just a couple weeks ago marked that dividing line. And as I've reflected on that, not just for the writing of this book, but just in general, I've come to appreciate the older I've gotten, and now that I'm well into my years as a father, the ways in which he had to make so many choices that, quite frankly, for any of us in the second, third, fourth, tenth generation are unthinkable. We sort of take for granted in American life the idea that we are a nation of immigrants and that the immigrant experience is prototypically American, but we don't usually stop to think about just how completely wrenching it is to decide you're going to uproot from a place that formed you, a place that shaped your whole identity and values, and plant yourself somewhere new in new soil. And so for my father, he grew up very deeply steeped in a sense of Chineseness. He was often sick as a kid, and so he spent many, many hours as a kid, he would tell me, just reading the Chinese classics and getting really imbued with a sense of history and values and culture in China. His father, my paternal grandfather, was in the Chinese nationalist military. He ended up being a general and a leader of their fledgling air force. And his father's name in Chinese is Liu Guoyun, Liu being my family name. And Guoyun translates into deliverance of the nation, which is
no pressure, exactly.
a low-pressure name there. And so my father grew up with this sense both of I'm deeply Chinese and also to be a Liu means to try to contribute, to be part of something bigger than yourself. And so fast forward to my having grown up here in the United States. I was born in Poughkeepsie, New York, in the Hudson Valley, and raised in this sort of classically suburban, middle-class environment. And on the one hand, I absorbed, of course, the world that I grew up in. I ate Doritos and drank Coke. I watched baseball. I went to the mall and played video games. I was just as American as any other Gen X kid of the 70s and 80s. At the same time, just because of my father's own heritage, I grew up in this very suffused with this same sense of Chineseness, which, again, I came only to appreciate more fully years later, ways in which my values, my appreciation of context and history and social obligation, and recognizing that contrary to the often shorthand American way of every man for himself and rugged individualism, that I'd been really raised in a sense of we're woven into this fabric of relationship and obligation. And then that's deeply Chinese. And that's one way. Now, the other way, though, going back to my grandfather's name, is I grew up also with the sense of Lus should somehow be responsible, at least in their small part, for the deliverance of their nation. And my nation was not China. My nation was not Taiwan. My nation is the United States. And so I grew up with this equally ardent sense of I need to be a contributor. I need to show up. I need to be involved. And I'm going to channel all of that energy and that family heritage into the deliverance of this nation, America, if I can.
I thought it was fascinating that you wrote about this strong sense of patriotism that you have for the United States, but you're also aware that you are sort of wired to be the kind of person who would be attached to whatever country he'd been born into. And I thought that perspective on patriotism is amazing, because so few people who feel like patriots think it might have something to do with their temperament as opposed to living in the best country on earth, no matter where they happen to be from.
It happens to be nice when both those things align. Right,
right? Of course.
but I actually do think, yes, I am ardent by nature. I'm a joiner and a believer, and I have a strong yearning to be part of something bigger than myself. And you know, the peeling of the onion of identity means you never quite know how much of that is literally in your DNA. And how much of that, in my case, was simply being second generation, right? Being the child of immigrants and being aware of the relative newness and somewhat fragile nature of our family roots here, and wanting, therefore, to double down on claiming this place, that might have been part of it as well. But I think I want to be, you know, I want to be very clear about one thing about patriotism. When I talk about patriotism, I do not mean blind celebration of the greatness of our country. I don't mean chest thumping about we're number one. We are number one in many ways, but there are many ways in which we're not number one. Mm-hmm. And to me, true patriotism in the United States is about whether and to what extent and how hard we push ourselves to live up to our stated creed. We are exceptional in that we are a nation dedicated to a proposition. But that exceptionalism is not one of pat yourself on the back and say it's all good. That exceptionalism is an exceptional burden. It means that we forever as a country are not yet fully in alignment with our ideals and in alignment with our creed. And even today, though we live in an age of progress, and here I am talking with you in this wonderful show, you know, a thing that might have been unthinkable 75 years ago, the fact of the matter is every day in every corner of our country and every corner of your state, the United States is still not living up to its creed. And so true patriotism means nudging us toward ever greater alignment. And to me, you know, that's a notion that is deeply American, but it's also influenced, again, by my Chinese sense of you take the long view of history and you're always trying to push yourself to live up to an ideal.
I want to go back to this family value that you mentioned of really valuing group well-being and social cohesion, whereas American values sort of call for a kind of brash independence. And of course, you could overstate either of those things pretty easily. But those are hard. It's hard to walk the line between those two ideas about what it means to be a person in society.
You know, it is. And you're absolutely right, Chris, that you can take either of those ideas too far or oversimplify them. And yet, there are certain cultural cores that are real. There's just been some great, interesting educational and psychology research over the last bunch of years that reveals this. There's a professor at the University of Michigan named Richard Nisbet who's done this research studying Asians in Asia, Asian Americans, and then non-Asian Americans. So these kind of three points of a spectrum. And when you look at Asians in Asia, say native-born Japanese or Chinese subjects in these studies, he'll show them a picture of an aquarium and ask them to study this picture for a few minutes and then later on try to recall what was in that picture. And he'll do the same for non-Asian, say white Americans. Same picture of the same aquarium. And the Chinese in China will look at that picture, and later on what they will remember is the relationship among the elements in the aquarium, where the rock stood in relation to this fish, where the filter was in relation to that thing, and just kind of the overall schema, the gestalt of the whole aquarium. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Americans, the non-Asian, the white Americans, would be asked to recall the picture, and what they'd remember was the brightest, shiniest, biggest object in the tank. Right. and sort of the stereotype ends up holding at the level of psychology. It ends up holding at the level of education and values and norms. And so, I think even as we take that grain of salt and recognize that stereotypes can be overly blunt, we recognize that there are certain cultural truths to the ways in which different societies have accentuated different things. And, you know, for me, growing up Chinese American, I absolutely grew up with this American sense of you can reinvent yourself, you can make your own way, you can imagine yourself to be self-made, and that there's very little to hold you back in terms of tradition or history or obligation to keep you from pursuing your dreams, even if your dreams may seem to others iconoclastic. I grew up that way. I grew up valuing those kinds of figures and stories. At the same time, you cannot grow up in a Chinese household without recognizing several things. Number one, your relationship to the larger context, family, extended family. You cannot grow up in a Chinese household without being far more attentive, frankly, to notions of face and how things will seem and whether the reputational costs or benefits of your actions and choices and omissions will redound to your family's benefit. These things are always in the air. You can't grow up in a Chinese household and not be aware of the ways in which history and a sense of you have been formed and shaped by things long, long beyond anybody's living memory, and yet they still matter. And why do they matter? They matter because they matter, right? Which is not exactly an American way of thinking. And so, for me, in the best case scenario, Chinese Americans confuse the most adaptive and healthy elements of both these traditions. And to take it out of the realm of theory, I point to a couple of people in my book today who embody this best of all worlds fusion. I think about a fellow named Tony Hsieh, who is the entrepreneur, the dot-com entrepreneur who founded Zappos.com, where most of us buy shoes and other things that got acquired by Amazon a few years ago and made Tony a very, very prosperous, wealthy man. And on the one hand, his story is the classic American story of an individual who didn't care what people thought and started this online marketplace and sold it for a great profit. And that's totally American. What a hero individual. At the same time, if you actually peel again a little bit more deeply into his story, you realize what's Tony Hsieh doing with some of his fortune? He's investing $300 million of his earnings from Zappos into revitalizing downtown Las Vegas, where his company's located, this most American of places, and to try to build a real community in that civic desert. That, to me, is kind of Chinese, and that's a fusion that I'm excited about.
Eric Liu is my guest. His new book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Eric Liu. He is founder and CEO of Citizen University and a correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think at kera.org. So, Eric, as a first-generation American, a son of immigrants, you have the job of deciding who you are in your country. You also have the job of either absorbing or fending off what everybody outside your family's culture thinks you are based on the color of your skin and the place that your parents were born.
Yeah, I think that's you put it really well. And, you know, the one thing I would say is the language I use actually is I describe myself as a second generation American. My parents who emigrated here were the first generation to claim this country, to become American. They became naturalized. But I was born here. And I think the second generation identity, whether you're talking as we are about Chinese Americans or quite frankly any ethnicity in American immigrant history, this is, we often have the cliche that America is a nation of immigrants. But really, what America is a perpetually second generation nation.
Hmm.
I think that when we are at our best, it is living in precisely the tension, Chris, that you're describing between having a sense of wanting to hold on to the best, most healthy parts of the heritage that your immigrant forebears brought here, whilst also at the same time feeling free, literally free, to make your own story, to make your own self, to make your own identity, and to make your own community. And that second generation story isn't even just about race and ethnicity. If you think about, you know, the founding generation of this nation, we may lionize them, but really it falls to the second generation, the Daniel Webster generation, to really figure out, okay, how do we take this great idea, this legacy that we've been handed by people who made a great fabric-tearing sacrifice, and how do we sustain some meaning and utility out of the sacrifice that they bore for us? That's the perpetual American question. And so as a second-generation kid, I'm super conscious that every opportunity I've ever had in my life comes with an equal or greater obligation. And I think one of the things that we as Americans forget when we are, you know, as we are right now in harder economic times and there's more fear and anxiety and the sense that everything is zero sum. And so you get anger like you do at the southwest border. You get this resentment that immigrants are coming in and taking over. And then you see other headlines about China's rise and what China's doing to become a competitor and perhaps a threat to the United States. And there is this instinct that begins to take hold in the American heart to want to close borders, close minds, close hearts. And I think that's not just unkind. I think it's completely self-destructive. Because the idea of America is that we stay open long enough for a second generation to set root here and to begin to redefine what it means to be American.
So there is so much richness and beauty in that complexity that you described, in that complex relationship to your country. I wonder if you ever envied the simplicity of being like 43rd generation Chinese in China or French in France. Or, you know what I'm saying?
You know, envy is the wrong word. I sometimes wonder what it would be like, but envy is in fact quite the opposite of the word that I would use. Mm. I think there is a great, as you say, beauty and wonder to being situated on that edge as the second generation is, and to wonder, as I do, how much of my patriotism is rooted in the words of Thomas Jefferson and the other Enlightenment thinkers who shaped Jefferson, and how much of it is it actually rooted in Confucianism? How much of it is it rooted in a sense of rights as duties and a sense that obligations attend opportunities? Because it turns out that that does connect both Confucius and Thomas Jefferson. And so to explore those kinds of questions and to ask yourself, what am I made of? And then in turn, as you look down to the next generation, what am I supposed to pass on? I think it's endlessly rich and interesting. And, you know, one of the things that we've got to reckon with in this country is that, look, as China rises and becomes more strong and becomes this threat competitor nation out there, we shouldn't get anxious. I actually don't care how large and mighty China gets. I don't care how great their GDP gets. The United States always retains a potential competitive advantage, which I boil down this way. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. China does not want to. They're not interested in it. They don't know how to. That's not their operating system to take talent, people, bloodlines, memes, ideas from the rest of the world and then fuse and integrate them into new, crazy, complex hybrids that redefine the very idea of Chineseness. That's not their deal. That's not their game. And so to be 43rd generation Han Chinese, where all you have is this straight line heritage, to me, you know, yes, there are benefits to that. You have a sense of rootedness. But the benefits of what we have here in America, potentially, if we don't blow it, if we actually learn how to exercise it, is one of endless creative imagination.
It is interesting to think about living in a country of immigrants and immigration, to dwell on the fact that most immigrants, as you say, have to have, you know, some courage to pick up and leave everything they have known. They're sort of a self-selecting group, and maybe they're different from the people who never wanted to leave in the first place.
I think that's right. I just invite you or me, as I've done from time to time, or any of our listeners to really hit pause on their lives, assuming they were born in this country, and think about what it would be like right now to give yourself even a month. You know, it doesn't have to be overnight. Give yourself a month to plan, pick up everything, and decide to leave this country forever and decide to make some other country your home and decide to make that other country a place where you're going to raise kids knowing that they're going to be raised in a milieu with a set of values and beliefs that are fundamentally different from the ones that you grew up with. And you'll recognize that as much as we celebrate that immigrant spirit, the reality is most native-born Americans no longer even have that same level of gumption and willingness to take that kind of risk. And that is a thing that we've got to continuously reinfuse into American culture and the American body politic.
So tell us about your daughter. I thought the things that you wrote about her were fascinating. She is a third generation American. She is, I guess, ethnically half Chinese.
That's right.
She has really had some interesting periods in her life where she explored that in different ways.
That's right. And she's still exploring. She's 15 years old. And what I write about in my book is the ways in which early on, particularly when she was younger, I took it upon myself to really lay some sort of foundation of Chineseness for her. And, you know, one of the things that I write about that is, you know, in the more personal parts of the book is this year that I call the Year of Ming. And this was a year when my daughter, whose name is Olivia, decided that she was going to change her name from Olivia and use her Chinese name, Ming. Her name in Mandarin is Liu Ming. And so she did it in this very determined way where she just started going to school and not responding to teachers when they called her Olivia, insisting that they called her Ming, scratching out her nameplate and telling all her friends, I'm Ming. And she just loved for this stretch of time being attached to anything Chinese, learning Chinese, reading Chinese, watching cartoons that had Chinese characters, whatever it was. Of course, as I write about in the book, this was also the year after my marriage had failed. And so it was a year where we were intensely bonded together. And I think about that time and, you know, on a personal human level, forget about race, ethnicity, culture, civilization. It's just a time when a father is trying to be to a daughter and a daughter to a father all that they can be when they both realize the fragility and the non-permanence of things. But when you do overlay the specific the specifics of Chineseness, to me, that year was so beautiful and powerful. And then, you know, it's a little bit longer than a year, probably about 15, 18 months. She had decided, okay, I've done that. And she had kind of come through that passage, both our family passage as we navigated to a new normal, and also just her own identity passage. And it wasn't that she wanted to shut out Chineseness or put it away, but she was just like, okay, I'm done being Ming. I'm Olivia again. And so she similarly, summarily announced to all her friends and teachers and everybody that, you know, you can go back to calling me Olivia. And, you know, now that she's a teenager, you know, again, she's got so many influences on her sense of self and her sense of identity. And I feel like all I've tried to do is to give her enough of this foundation of language, access, exposure, She's not fluent in Chinese, far from it, but we do have this weekly little tutorial ritual that we started when she was 8 or 9. Every Tuesday afternoon, I'm teaching her some Chinese, and I hope that she'll be able to carry that with her the rest of her life. I think she probably knows enough about things, having just watched my own arc of identity, to know that she can't predict whether in 5, 10, 15, 25 years she's going to have another stretch where she really wants to be Ming again. Mm. And when that comes, I want her to have access to the full breadth of what that means.
Explain how you do those language lessons, by the way. She makes up ridiculous sentences and you have to translate or vice versa?
Yeah, we've done it a lot of ways. You know, for a while, I just tried to do it literally by the book. I took off the shelf the textbooks that I used to use as a kid for Chinese, and I would give her these sentences. And of course, you know, they're deadly boring. Right. I have a line in my book that says, you know, those who ignore Chinese school, as I did when I was forced to go there on Sundays as a kid, those who ignore Chinese school are doomed to repeat it, right? And I've had to started trying to repeat it using literally the same texts, and she found it equally boring and absurd to learn these very stilted sentences. And so then I said, okay, well, let's make this more of a game. How about you make up sentences in English, and then I'll translate them into Chinese, and then you've got to learn the translation and understand why things were translated this way. And my daughter is an incredibly playful, mischievous kid. And so she just started making up the most absurd sentences you could make up about, you know, how many gnomes were climbing on your back before you had, you know, fried eggs for breakfast with the king of Persia, right? And that would be her sentence or something like that. And then, you know, I'd have to spend 40 minutes literally trying to figure out how the heck do I put that in Chinese? But once I did it, that became the basis of our study, right? And she would literally then unpack that and learn to write those words and learn, understand the order of things in Chinese sentences and begin to develop this. I do believe she has this deep instinctive sense now of where nouns and verbs go in Chinese sentences and how that's different from American, from English sentences. The ways in which Chinese as a language lacks the prepositions and the interstitial words that we use in English, so that, again, even the language itself relies on context for understanding in just the way that Chinese culture is so relational and contextual. And I think she really does have a deep understanding of this, even if she wouldn't put it in those terms, which are kind of a dad's nerdy pedagogical terms. But we've tried to do it through fun.
I saw a documentary recently about education. It wasn't really about ethnic education, but there was a young woman who had chosen a historically black college and said, the interesting thing about being at school here is that my identity, I'm forced to think about something else other than the obvious. I guess she had been in high school with mostly non-black students. And I wonder if that's been the situation for you, was the situation for you or your daughter. How much Chineseness were you surrounded by when you left the house in Poughkeepsie?
Boy, that's a great both observation and question, and again, one that connects this particular experience of Chinese-American identity with the universal experience of Americanness, and not even the immigrant identity. I think your example of someone who goes to a historically black college and is wrestling with the meaning or the not meaning of African-American identity can connect to these things. You know, for me, I grew up in this largely white suburb in upstate New York, and had this very heightened awareness of ways in which I was different. And part of that got translated into a real desire to fit in and a real insecurity about my race and identity that really wasn't until I went to college and really was among many more, not just Chinese Americans, but Asian Americans in general, and really became exposed to the very idea of Asian America, right? I mean, we again take for granted this notion, but it's that concept that you would lump together the peoples of essentially one side of the planet from dozens of nations with dozens of languages and ethnicities and faith traditions and roll them up into a yellowish-brown category called Asian is one of the most American things you can do, right? and they don't do that in Asia, right? Mm-hmm. And the Koreans are quite attuned to the differences between them and Japanese, and Chinese are quite attuned to the difference between them and Vietnamese. And within China, you're attuned to the difference between Han Chinese and other kinds of ethnic minorities. And this kind of rolling it up into an Asian identity is something that was a bit of a revelation for me in my college years. But really, you know, I've lived in Seattle now for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the great beauties of being in this part of the country, which is Asia-facing, Pacific in its orientation, and in which Asian Americans have been for so long part of public life, right? I mean, not just governors and elected officials and public leaders like that, but I'll never forget one of my first visits to Seattle, probably about 15 years ago. I walked out of the apartment I was staying in, visiting, and I looked down the street, and there was the mailman. And the mailman was Asian. And I had literally never seen an Asian American mailman before. And I thought, wow, I'm in a different world. I'm in a place where it's just a matter of course that Asian Americans are woven into every dimension of community and public life, and we get to claim and have that voice and identity. And that was one of the things that drew me here. But you know, to your example about the woman at the historically black college, I think you use the word heritage and how that student was able, because she was in an all-black environment, to really attend to things in a way other than her heritage, which had been so saliently noticed when she was a minority in a largely white context. It makes me think that one of the things that we've got to do, again, whatever our background is learn as Americans to distinguish between heritage and identity. Heritage is what we have been given, or in some ways, what has been forced upon us as a matter of cultural inheritance, as a matter of how people see us, as a matter of the values, mores, and norms and styles that people around us try to bequeath to us. Identity is about what we call ourselves, what we make of ourselves, how we construct ourselves and compose ourselves. And I think, you know, the beauty of American life is that we are able to take the material of heritage, but not be so confined by it that we can't invent some part of our own identity. And for me, you know, this Chinese American identity is one where, as we can talk a bit about after the break, it combines aspects of my heritage, but it's also about new acts of invention and claiming and mixing and matching things.
My guest is Eric Liu. He is founder and CEO of Citizen University and a one-time speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. His new book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Eric Liu about his new memoir, A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. And Eric, before the break, you were saying that identity is the combination of heritage and these new acts of invention. Talk about what those acts might be.
Well, I think, you know, let me start with just what may seem to be a simple choice of grammar. When I say Chinese American, when I write Chinese American, I choose not to hyphenate it. The hyphen, which is actually the dominant convention and what I think journalism schools tell you should do, to me signifies something else. I say Chinese space American. To me, American is the noun and Chinese the adjective. Chinese is one of the adjectives I use to describe myself. I'm also a short American. I'm a politically active American. I'm a baseball-loving American. But Chineseness looms very large as, you know, in the collection of adjectives that modify the noun that I am, which is American. And to me, the idea of hyphenation signifies something else. When I see something like Chinese hyphen American, I think about the interplay or the interaction between two parties, between two nations. And so that hyphen is appropriate if you're going to talk about Chinese hyphen American conflict or Chinese hyphen American trade or Chinese hyphen American diplomacy as between China and America. But I'm not a state of interplay between two nations. I am an American, and what that then means, then how we define American. And you know, that gets to this question of constant reinvention. I think we're in this age which I think to some is disconcerting, to me is very, you know, exciting, a period of incredible demographic flux where when we ask the timeless American question of who is us, the picture that pops in your mind can no longer reliably be a middle-aged white guy. That for a good long time was essentially the picture that popped into anybody's minds, whether here or around the rest of the world, when you just did the quick word association game and said American. Today, that face, the voice, the palette, the style, the songs that come out of that the mouth of that face are all so much more richly complex, and not just diverse in the sense of you have different people from around the world, but diverse in the sense that strange, wonderful, beautiful new combinations are being made. You know, we live in a nation that is essentially not a not just a burgers and fries nation. It's a kimchi burrito nation. You know, it's a nation where we are mixing and melding all these different things. And that is the source of our continuous inventiveness as Americans. Again, if we don't blow it, if we don't kill the goose that lays those golden eggs.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
My question for Eric is actually about his older book. It might have been his first book. It's called Accidental Chinese. I remember years ago reading it, and because my own background, I didn't quite agree with it, but I understood that he was born in this country and I wasn't. So I'd like to know now that it's been so many years later, he has a child and he's older, and how does he feel different now? Would he still write the book the same, with the same views, or is there something that he might feel that's changed?
Thanks for your call, Nancy.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's really great. The book that Nancy's referring to is my very first book called The Accidental Asian, and it was written in 1998, so 16 years ago. And, you know, the part of the in many ways, my new book, A Chinaman's Chance, is a bookend to that book. It's meant to bracket, in a sense, an education. When I wrote The Accidental Asian, it was a book saying, among other things, you know, Chris, as you and I were talking about earlier, expressing my ambivalence about this invented identity called Asian, this throwing together of all of these different ethnicities in a way that was supposed to carry cultural and political meaning, and my worry that you know, as wonderfully American as that was, that the very act of creating, you know, new blocks of color like that was still at best going to be a transitional phase for Americans, and might hold us back from truly seeing and understanding one another. I would say a lot of things have changed since I wrote that book. As Nancy alluded to, I myself have become a parent and have been raising a third generation, ethnically half Asian, half Chinese daughter. But the other, as I was saying earlier, is that I've now lived these last 14 years in Seattle and been engaged in the civic and the cultural and community life of a town where there is a strong tradition of pan-ethnic, pan-Asian culture and organizing and politics and just community. And I would say all these things have shaped me and changed me so that, number one, I do appreciate the value of simply having that identity to claim, invent, and belong to, the pan-ethnic Asian identity. And at the same time, though, recognizing that for myself, still the most meaningful part of identity and what it was that I wanted to really mine and explore more deeply in this new book was the Chinese-ness part, the specifically being Chinese, not just Asian, and trying to unpack what that would mean. But I would say for sure that these years have given me a more fluid and capacious sense of, you know, accepting different labels and forms of identity and really appreciating the power of belonging to a pan-ethnic, pan-Asian community as I do now here in Seattle, where so many of my friends and mentors have been from that community to shape me.
You write about the fact that in American culture, Chinese men are assumed somehow to be less masculine than men of certain other ethnic backgrounds, which is honestly something I've never fully understood. Do you understand where it comes from? And is it something that you had to struggle with more when you were like a very young man as opposed to now as you approach middle age?
You know, I think it's as far as the origins of it, I think from the time that it's kind of ironic because when Chinese immigrants were coming to this country, they were doing the most physically grueling, back-breaking labor and doing it in more enduringly hard ways for lower wages that ended up earning them the resentment of native-born white laborers. And so if anything, you know, the earliest Chinese immigrants were among the manliest of men you could find on planet Earth. But I think part of what ended up happening there is part of just a general demonization, a general whipping up of a sense of yellow peril that Chinese cheap labor was coming, that Chinese with strange methods and values were infiltrating and corrupting American society and American values. That part of what ended up happening, again, also because those first waves of immigrants were bachelor generations and very few women came here, was a set of stereotypes that emerged to feminize and to belittle Chinese and, in general, Asian men. By the time that I was growing up, again, a kid in a suburb in upstate New York, I wouldn't say that that stereotype was particularly prevalent or on my mind, but there was this vague sense in which, you know, I knew then that there was this prevailing emerging stereotype of Chinese and, frankly, all Asian men and women as model minorities, as perfect little nerds who were automatons and did their schoolwork and had no social skills, wouldn't make eye contact and didn't do anything to participate in anything other than just hitting the books. And I resented that stereotype. I hated it. And I spent a lot of time in my youth, I would say, pushing back hard against that stereotype. And trying, okay, that's the stereotype. Well, then I'm going to go join the wrestling team and I'm going to do these other things. Even as I did other stuff that did fit the stereotype, like achieve in school. And yes, I played the violin, right? But, you know, for me, I came to realize, and I wrote about this in my first book, The Accidental Asian, that when you are working so hard to defy stereotype, you are essentially still a prisoner of the stereotype. You are not yet getting to live who you are and what you want to be. And if who you are and what you want to be is somebody who plays violin 5 hours a day and hits the book super hard and just derives great purpose and satisfaction from that, you ought to be able to do that without feeling like you're dancing, you know, shadowboxing some stereotype that exists out there. For me now as a parent, you know, one reason why I'm hopeful about just America and these questions of identity is my daughter's generation, this millennial and these post-millennial generations are growing up with such a more fluid, in a sense, playful notion of identity and how you can take stereotypes that people, you know, my age might have taken quite seriously in our youth and essentially laugh at them and throw them off. And you know, does that mean that racism is over or that institutional racism has been abolished? No, a million miles from that. But it does mean that this rising generation is able, I think, to understand in a much more sophisticated way the necessities and the hypocrisies of identity and race in America that I think will help us move forward.
When you travel to other parts of the world, would people, say, in China, lump all, you know, North Americans, South Americans together in one big group? Or is that reduction of the other something that is unique to the United States?
I think to a certain extent, it's probably human nature. But it's particularly pronounced in the United States, again, because this is a country that has literally nothing to hold us together but a simple creed. A set of documents, a loose set of cultural practices that we've shared together, and probably more than anything else, perhaps to our detriment, you know, a culture of market capitalism, right? I mean, we are bound together by the Super Bowl and, you know, free buffalo wings at TGIFs, you know, as much as we are by the, you know, the preamble to the Constitution or the Gettysburg Address. But it's in a country like this where there is so little in the way of blood, tribe, shared soil, shared history that unites us, that we are a bit more anxious about creating categories and trying to fit people into and lump people into boxes and notions that allow us to make sense of one another. And again, that's both understandable and something that we have to learn to reckon with. And to reckon with them is not to, I want to be very clear, to say that we should ignore race. I quite couldn't disagree more with a statement of the sort that Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice John Roberts said, that the way to get beyond discrimination on the basis of race is to get beyond discrimination on the basis of race, as if it were simply the matter of being awakened to a tautology. Oh, gosh, that logic is unassailable. I guess everything's okay. The reality is that everywhere around us today, we live with legacies of discrimination and injustice based on race, and that's particularly pronounced in the case of the African-American experience. But it's true, I think, of people of all different colors and backgrounds. And learning to be able to hold in our heads simultaneously these two ideas, that there is still a legacy and that things are getting better, is our American challenge and tension.
If by some miracle you could get a message to your late father, wherever he is, would you? What would you want him to know about your life today and how you've turned out?
Wow, Chris, that's a great question. I think I would want him to know that I have tried literally as hard as I could to earn it, to earn everything that he tried so hard to make possible, to sacrifice for, to create possibilities for, and that I've tried really hard to earn it, and earn it not in the sense of aggrandizing or enriching myself, but earn it in the sense of making some contribution that hopefully will outlive me. And, you know, that's what infuses me with this sense of purpose. And I would say that, you know, my dad's early death, really just lit me with a sense of purpose that continues today to have made the sacrifices of previous generations of his life somewhat worthwhile by trying to show up the best way that I can today.
Were you excited to have your daughter read this book for the first time?
Yes, I was a little bit hesitant because, of course, you know, she's a teenager, so almost anything I say can and will be used against me. but B, you know, we're talking about stuff that is just in the life of our family. And I think she came to appreciate it in the sense of recognizing that the stories that I tell about how we've grown up together and how, and I mean that, about how I've tried to raise her, but have tried to grow as a man and as a father in trying to raise her and to grow as a Chinese American, is a story that she's part of already, and that at some point down the road, she's going to have to carry the next chapter of. And I think on some level, for all her teenage, eye rolling that she might do, she gets that. And I guess that's something else I would want to tell my dad, that my daughter, who has every bit of his mischievousness and playfulness, does on some level get what it means to be American.
Eric Liu's new book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream. Eric, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you so much. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.